This morning we are going to have a look at the contemplation of Vedana, usually translated feeling. The practice that we're doing, in English people generally refer to it as insight meditation, is what the Buddha called satipatthana, the establishing of mindfulness, or the foundations of mindfulness. Now there are four areas where mindfulness is applied or established. The first is body. And so we've been, through this retreat, focusing on the body. The second is Vedana, or feeling. The third is Chitta, heart or mind. And the fourth is Dharma, which we probably won't get to talk much about. So this second one, feeling, is quite important, has a central role in the practice. What I'd like to do is to start by doing a meditation experiment to see if we can work out what exactly the Buddha is talking about when he says Vedana, or what we would say feeling. So if you get into your meditation posture, and again, this is an experiment, a game, so just play with it, don't take it too seriously. Anything can happen, maybe nothing will happen. So settling into the posture, constructing the posture from the ground up, opening up to the whole body, experiencing the whole body. And from there, focus in on the movements within the body that indicate the breathing. Find those movements and start to focus in on them. Watch these movements. Watch the breathing. Observe the breathing. Be the witness of your own breathing. And be alert to this relationship. Watch the breathing. And now, feel the breathing. Don't watch it. Don't witness it. But feel it. Feel the breathing. And notice if there's any difference in the relationship. Feel the breathing. Don't watch it. Just feel it. Open up again to the whole body, experiencing the whole body. And from there, ask yourself, how do I feel now? Let yourself become intimate with that feeling. You could name it, if that helps, or not bother. If the naming gets in the way, just feel it. How do I feel now? Okay. Is there any difference between watching the breathing and feeling the breathing? Or is it the same? Sorry?
For me, there was a definite difference.
What was the difference?
When I was watching the breathing, I was really aware of the mechanics of respiration, I guess. The chest expanding and the diaphragm going up and down. When I was feeling the breath, and it was sort of more focalized in that immediate area. Whereas when I was feeling the breathing, the tension got away from the mechanics of breathing, and there was just a receptiveness with the in-breath, with the inhalation, of fresh energy coming in, and then that being expired. And after a few breaths, there was this almost effervescent feeling, light feeling throughout the body.
Mm-hmm.
Warm light feeling throughout the body that seemed to permeate the whole system. Yeah.
So the watching is more mechanical, more detailed, more analytical?
For me it was, yeah.
And the feeling was more diffuse, more general, but it also spread out, less localized.
Yeah.
So there's this sense of spreading out through the whole body. It also sounds like it was pleasant.
I found it so, yes.
Mm. Yeah. Anybody else have?
The theory is more spacious.
Spacious. So watching is more
condensed,
and feeling is more spacious.
There's a lot more going on, but that's the decline.
Yep.
That's a little more direct to me. The experience was a lot more grounded or direct.
And which one?
Feeling.
Feeling is more grounded and more direct.
Mm. And very pleasant.
And pleasant, more pleasant. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I found similar. I felt like feeling was more direct and here one was sort of more abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Stepped back more.
Is it a question of distance? It's like feeling is closer and watching is more distant? You're nodding your head too?
Yeah, I felt like an observer when I was watching,
uh-huh.
even though it was me breathing.
Yeah.
But when I was feeling it, I felt much more part of the experience.
So being an observer means you have to separate yourself from it.
I felt.
But when you're feeling, you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
More, so it's more intimate feeling.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I do this experiment is it's quite interesting the number of people who do have strikingly different experiences,
mm-hmm.
depending on whether you use the concept watch or you use the concept feel. And it's interesting because in my experience, when people talk about using breathing as a meditation object, they invariably say to watch it. And you get this whole thing about being the witness and witnessing and so on. Why aren't we told to feel it? Some people find feeling is actually much more satisfactory than watching. Some people have said, almost jumped up and said, "Hallelujah, praise the Lord. I've been wasting my time trying to watch the breath all this time. I can just feel it." For other people, there's absolutely no difference. Invariably, in a group of people, I'll ask this now, was there anyone for whom there was absolutely no difference? Yeah. Invariably. For some people, there is no difference whatsoever. For some people, it's as different as night versus day. And for other people, there's absolutely no difference whatsoever. It's there's no set rules about these things. The whole thing is very individual. Part of it is, and you can see that this is an exercise in suggestion, isn't it? It's like, use a different word, do you or don't you get a different experience? Some people will, some people won't. One of the things that comes out of this is how important the concept is. Change the concept, you change the experience. Very interesting. So be careful with the concepts. When we went to the whole body and asked the question, how do I feel now? What happened then? Anything? Anything worth reporting? Yes, Diane.
I guess I'm having a little confusion between the emotional tone and the physical feeling. Feeling to me can mean more emotion than an actual physical feeling. So when we went to how do I feel now, the older version was there and not pinpointing on a physical characteristic, so maybe I got confused.
The confusion is deliberate, because you notice I've done absolutely nothing to define feeling. I haven't made any attempt to say what we're actually talking about. So it's what you feel feeling is. And it sounds like, although you have a concept that it's somehow physical, that actually you went to the more emotional side, what we call emotion. Yeah. One of the things which I find interesting struck me a few years ago because of the central role when people talk about meditation practice. Often people talk about emotion, and I suddenly realised that I didn't know the Pali word for emotion, which I thought was odd, because obviously it's very central to insight meditation because everybody's talking about it. I'd never come across it, so I looked it up in the English Pali dictionary, and there were, I think, three terms given for emotion. All of them were compounds and all of them were late. The Buddha never talks about emotion. He never mentions it. There's ever come across the book it was one of the gatherings of the Dalai Lama and scientists. It was about
destructive emotions.
And I read that book and wondering if anybody in it would acknowledge the fact that the Buddha never talked about emotions. And there is one little bit. There's one little sentence where someone says, and it might have been the Dalai Lama, oh, and by the way, the Buddha never talks about it, but blah, 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 blah. I think the reason is because emotion is too crude a category for the Buddha. He is much more precise in his language. Emotion is complex. To have, and we're going to talk about emotion later on, but to have an emotion, there has to be some kind of narrative to identify the emotion. Mm. It's usually in the body. There's usually a physical sensation involved. And there's what the Buddha calls feeling. But there's the Buddha, when the Buddha talks about feeling, which we'll get to, he talks about three aspects of it: pleasant, painful, and neither. Emotion will always be either pleasant or painful. Has anybody ever had a completely neutral emotion? I've never found anybody who's put their hands up and said, yes, yes, yes. Is either pleasant or painful. So it's complex, and there's more to it. It's complex. It's a very broad category. And the Buddha speaks in much more precise terms, and that's why he never mentions it. Not because it didn't exist, but because he has a different way of framing it. The word Vedana comes from the verb vedati and vedayati, and as in English, it's ambiguous. We can use feeling as a noun. So my feeling about this is blah blah blah, and we can use feeling as a verb. I feel dot dot dot. So there's an ambiguity to it. A feeling is a something that we experience, and feeling is also a way of experiencing. And I think this is the bit where we get to when we look at people who discover different modes of experience when they use breathing. It's a mode of experiencing as much as something that we experience. But it's also something that we experience. There's an ambiguity. You know, for what the Buddha is getting at with Vedana and Vedati, to feel, is a mode of experience which tunes into the affective aspect of experience as distinct from the cognitive. By affect, we mean that which has an influence. that which moves us in some way. In other words, if we're talking about feeling, we're talking about response. Feeling, response. Why am I moved to do something? What when we say in English, you know, I was very moved by that. What do we mean by that? This is affect, influence. This is the realm of Vedana. Vedana is that aspect of experience which moves us in some way, that provokes a response. So one, the Buddha talks about consciousness or awareness, vijnana, and he talks about knowing, understanding, pajanati, panya, and these are essentially cognitive modes of experience, to know something. And there's also affective modes of experience, to feel something. And they go together. I can know what my feeling is. Alternatively, I might not know what my feeling is. I might be moved and not know that this is the way I'm being moved. An extreme example of that was a story told to me some years ago by a guy who was running a men's counselling group in a prison, and for serious offenders, and the members of this group were there because they had to be there. They were told, you've got to go. So they weren't volunteers. So it was a pretty weird group, he said. But after some time in the prison environment, he said he was really shocked one day when one of the there was a new member of the group, and this was a guy who was serving a sentence for some serious crime, and then had a life sentence added on top of that one because in the prison he murdered another inmate. He stabbed him to death. So he's in this group, and they're talking about anger, and the counsellor says to the guy who's in there for the double whammy, he says, when did you realise that you were angry with the guy you murdered? And the prisoner answered, while I was stabbing him. This is an extreme example, but it is possible to be moved and not know that we are moved. The other example that I like to give is Bill on the bus, which most of you have already heard. It's in a teaching that I received in Brisbane years ago when I was living there, and I was on a bus from West End to the city, and it was in summer, so it was very hot. And at this particular bus stop, this guy got on, and he would have been in his early 60s, very, very stiff, very overweight, dressed in, you know, shorts and singlets, and so a lot of flesh exposed and all of it seriously damaged by the sun. And so, in other words, a kind of typical older working class Queenslander, and comes down the aisle of the bus and sat in the seat behind me. And on that double seat, there was already another old codger who was sitting there, and they knew each other. So as the new guy was sitting down, the bloke who was already there says, g'day, Bill, how are you feeling? And Bill said, buggered if I know, mate. It's true, often buggered if we know. But the Buddha is suggesting that it's important that we do know. And this is the contemplation of feeling. It's tuning into that whole realm of affect, of the fact that we are moved and how we are moved. And it's central in the teaching on dependent arising. The Buddha says contact conditions feeling, feeling conditions craving. So contact is the immediacy of experience. And when the Buddha says contact conditions feeling, he's not saying that there's an experience and then later on a feeling turns up to join the party. He's saying if there is experience, there is already feeling. They go together. And it's not, you can't have an experience without a feeling. It's impossible. If there's an experience, there's a feeling. We are already moved. We may not know that we're moved, but we are already moved. So we're talking about stimulus response, this whole area. And feeling conditions craving. Craving is that drivenness that we've been talking about. So if we're looking for the source of our drivenness, we will find it in feeling. That's where it starts. But that relationship between feeling and craving is not necessary. One can have feeling without craving. And of course, this would characterize the awakened one. That the awakened one would have a full, what we would call, emotional life, but have no craving. Have not be driven. Be moved, but not driven. Which is a major difference. People often have the idea that if you're enlightened, you must be somehow emotionally shut down, which is obvious nonsense. So getting to understand feeling, is tuning into it, is very important. And one way of doing it is just to set yourself the job of feeling. I won't watch my meditation object, I'll feel it. That's one way of experimenting, of playing with it. Another way is to be alert to responses. So, for example, if I'm sitting and it's painful and I move, physically move, so something moved me to move. What was that? Start to look at that whole area. What moves me to respond? And I'm always responding. So what's behind that? This response. What I'd be doing would be investigating that whole area of feeling. You had a question?
Yeah, I was just curious, if it's a stimulus response, then there must be a gap. I mean, even though it's conditional, if you have a stimulus, you have a response, there has to be some time in which that response or some mechanism by which that response is generated.
Yep.
So is it possible to see the gap?
Yeah, theoretically. Why not? I can't recall anywhere where the Buddha talks about the gap between them, but that he wouldn't necessarily, even if he knew that there was one, because that whole question, of course, is very much coming at it from a scientific perspective. I want to examine the mechanics of this, and I want to break down the mechanics so I can understand it. And of course, the Buddha was not a scientist. He's more poet than scientist. So that could possibly be a question that he's simply not interested in. That for him, it's more of an existential approach of, we are already moved, and let's have a look at that. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the Abhidhamma they go into it.
I want to say that sometimes it's experienced in the reverse, where you experience the feeling first, even before the stimulus.
Yeah.
And that, you know, whatever happens mechanically, experientially, feeling is the kind of prominent piece that is more easily cognized.
It's when you have the Buddha presents things in certain, like he has lists, and so, you know, this conditions, this conditions, this conditions, this. In terms of experience, one may drop in at any point along the line. It's all happening, but that we may be sensitive to one aspect but not to another. So it's don't take the linear, don't take it in a linear way.
Just the mention of the Abhidhamma. Wouldn't that have to do with nama, with the speed of citta? Rises everyone in the fast that we don't realise.
Yeah, that may well be with the kanikavada, with the doctrine of momentariness. The standard loophole is, oh, we know that it's separate, it's just that it happened so quickly nobody can see it. So it's possible that someone would say, yes, there is a gap, but no one except the Buddha has ever noticed it. Well, who knows?
It reminds me of the discourse you spoke about last night where they're talking on faith.
Yeah.
But they hadn't experienced it.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's if we better not go there. It's a whole huge issue about the Abhidhamma and the way that the traditions develop intellectually. My personal theory is that every Buddhist tradition at some point in its history has been taken over by academics, and they've all gone downhill ever since.
I just want to add that I think it is possible to see the gap between feeling and craving.
Yeah.
And that's actually where the work is.
Yeah, that's a much looser relationship.
Right.
And that's thanks for reminding me of that. That when you were looking at how I am moved and how I am moved, that segues into am I driven and how am I driven. And that area is very fruitful for the insight meditator because I can be moved without being driven.
Mm-hmm.
That's the crucial point.
Well, it's a bit like that when you were discussing that experience you had in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
You were moved by the pleasure, something that you were.
And that was that was Vedana without tanha, feeling without craving, and it was actually more pleasant.
And you started eating on tanha, okay.
Yeah. When the Buddha talks about feeling, he talks about it in terms of three basic qualities. He talks about pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. This third one is often you see it translated as neutral feeling, but he does not say neutral. He says neither painful nor pleasant. It's an important distinction. Pleasant feeling is a response to hold. Painful feeling is the response to reject. Neither painful nor pleasant is the response of dunno, basically. Sometimes the dunno is so profound that just no idea about what's going on. Or it can be, don't know what to do about it. Don't know if I should hold it or not hold it. Go for it or not go for it. What I'd like to do now is do another exercise where we look at feeling in terms of these categories that the Buddha presents. Here, we're going back to feeling, but you notice now that we're a bit more clear about what it means. Or are we? Any questions about feeling? About what the Buddha's talking about when he talks about feeling?
What's the definition, the difference between feeling and emotion, the definition of it, really?
Well, the Buddha wouldn't provide a definition because he doesn't talk about emotion.
No, but is emotion more feeling?
It's more complex. I'll give you an example. There was years ago, when I was researching religious experience, I was reading this book about which related an experiment, and I'm a bit vague, because it's been so long, I'm a bit vague about the details, but it was essentially an experiment in which the subjects were given some kind of substance which stirred up a physical response in the body. And then they were being observed. And then they would be asked later to report on the experience. What is it that you experienced? And the subjects were divided up into pairs. And unknown to them, one member of each pair was actually part of the experiment. So you receive this substance which would stir up the body in some way, and you'd be sitting in a room. You know, you're supposed to experience this, and then later on you'd be interviewed. So there'd be two people sitting in the room. And then that's because they start to talk. And in the experiment, one of the people, their job would be to say things like, this is a bit sus, isn't it? I mean, what are they giving to us? This could be anything. This could be really dangerous. That could be destroying our lives. That could be destroying our health. They're treating us like guinea pigs, like rats, and so on and so forth. Where the other group, the second person in each pair would be saying things like, isn't this great? Isn't this fantastic? Isn't it wonderful to be part of science and to be part of the expansion of knowledge and blah 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 blah. And so then they interview them after. So what did you feel as a result of this stuff? The people who had the complainer would be saying, "Oh, I felt anger, I felt irritation, I felt blah blah." Whereas the people who were with the cheerleader would say, "Oh, I felt happy, I felt contented, I felt so and so forth." So it was what was going on in the body was exactly the same for everybody, but the emotion that arose depended on the narrative. Put in one narrative, you have a certain emotion. Put in another narrative, you have another emotion. The emotion was what the person thought it meant.
That's more the story behind it.
Story, you always have story in emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You can, more subtly, you can have a mood which you can't quite identify. That would be closer to feeling, I think.
Yeah.
But if you have an emotion, you've got, first of all, the body is stirred up in some way. Secondly, there is some narrative to tell you what this is about. For example, I cannot feel anger unless I have a narrative running through the mind in which someone did something that they should not have done.
Yeah.
And that's quite a complex scenario. You know, so would a lion feel anger? Would a lion have that degree of narrative complexity? So, and plus, you have strong vedana, either pleasant or painful. And these are the two obvious ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you either enjoy it or you don't enjoy it. And sometimes with emotion, it can flip from one to the other in the same emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Or an emotion can rapidly change into another emotion, depending on whether it's registered as pleasant or registered as painful. And you have what I'll talk about when we do citta, and you have, it's more like a felt essence of the emotion, but we leave that aside, we'll go into that later. So emotion is complex. If you have an emotion, you will have vedana, but you can have vedana without an emotion. So vedana is a necessary building block of emotion, but it's not emotion.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is there a difference between neither present, neither pain, and both? Would there be any difference between these two?
Between neither and both?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether. Well, the Buddha doesn't. I don't think he uses the category both. I think if it's perceived as both, it might be that pleasant and painful that's moving rapidly from one to the other. And so it's being picked up on both sides of the spectrum. One thing about vedana is when you start to experience it, to look for it, it can often manifest as a kind of mosaic, that there's this little pockets of it, or little pixels of it just appearing everywhere. So at a less detailed view, it's both.
So it's not I don't know. It's not I don't know, I feel pleasant or I feel pain. It is actually I feel both. I mean, it's a slightly different.
Yeah. Between these two, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a difference between not knowing or being confused about it. But you can be feeling both and then be confused about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that confusion has a certain feeling to it. Mm-hmm. So it's in, when you lay it out conceptually, it's quite straightforward. But when you go into experience, it's all mixed up. Which reminds me, one of the themes we're dealing with today is the whole relationship between what we might loosely call concept and reality. First of all, this is advice given, which I read in Burma, from somebody who was a book written about one of the many insight meditation methods that are available in Burma, in which vedana of the body is the primary object. A piece of advice the person said is, if you're using vedana as your meditation object, do not look for it. If you look for it, you won't find it. It's like, as a rough analogy, it's like looking for the glasses. Where are they? I'm sure I brought them in. I'm positive. But they're just gone. It's we can't find it because we're in it. It's the bleeding obvious. It's like telling a fish to look for water. What? Where is it? Yeah. So don't look for it. Rather, it's acknowledging I am already experiencing it. That's it. That's why it can be so tricky sometimes. Where if I look for it, it's like, oh, it's something special that sometimes I don't see. But there's never been a moment in my life in which I've been free of Vedana.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other thing about that, we're looking at our experience, we're studying our experience, and we're being given a conceptual framework as well, which is designed to help us read the experience. So we've got a relationship going on between the experience and the concept. Don't start with the concept and then try to match it to the experience. Rather, always stay with the experience and see whether or not that concept fits. You see the difference?
Mm.
If you go for the concept first and then try to jam it onto the experience, it will be artificial, heady, and you'll probably convince yourself that you're experiencing things that you aren't experiencing. Just stay with the actual experience. If the concepts don't fit, fine. The concepts don't fit. Maybe they're wrong. You know, why not? Why should the Buddha be right? But if the concept, you might be going along and something happens and then you realise, that's what he meant. That's what he's talking about. And the learning process is often like that. You hear something, you don't know what they're talking about. It could be years later. Ah, oh, that must be what he's talking about. Boom, it fits. So stay with, always give priority to the experience. If the concept doesn't fit, just forget the concept. Okay, yeah.
I think I have a real problem with this because I seem to have an aversion to wanting to be. Like, to, it's almost like it's difficult to let go, I think, of whether it's a witness, but I feel this sort of vulnerability with just feeling.
Mm.
So I sort of, I flip, I think, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So should I just keep sort of going there and coming back out and then going?
I think that's a good thing to do. I think it's be good to get to know that vulnerability. So you don't push it. You don't force yourself, okay, I must become intimate with feeling. But rather, okay, no, realizing there is that vulnerability, it's kind of you dip your foot in the water and then you pull back. And then gradually over time, you become more familiar with the whole thing and you'll be able to find out what's going on there. Because always what you're doing is you're looking for some entry into the whole complex, which is the body, the mind and the heart. You know, what's going on there? So you're looking for those little cracks where you can step in. And you don't have to, you never force your way in. And you don't have to stay there for very long. You just, oh, that's what's going on. Okay, I move here. And gradually the mind will come into its own balance. So there's no need to force the issue at all.
Yeah, it's almost like something could happen, or there's like a surprise or something. I don't know how to explain.
Yep. Yeah, and you're right. Anything could happen, and it does come as a surprise.
Might not be fun. And it might not be fun.
And it might not be fun. So, if I was you, I would respect your intuition.
Always good advice.
Sounds like the teddy bear's picnic.
Mm-hmm. What's the teddy bear's picnic?
If you go down to the woods today.
And this is, I mean, this practice is real, and we are going into the deep woods because we're going right into the heart and the mind.
Yeah.
and anything can happen. And some of it is not nice.
Yeah. I just want to say a word about neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling. And because this is something I experience a lot of the time, where I'm just not aware of a feeling response. I mean, there may well be one, but it's below the level of my awareness. And I think that covers a lot of ground for some people.
Yeah. And the other thing about this third one, neither painful nor pleasant, these are at the basement level, or the foundational level. At a more mature level, neither painful nor pleasant feeling becomes equanimity, and it becomes genuine neutral feeling. The first time I started taking contemplation of feeling seriously was many years ago. I was doing a retreat with a friend of mine who was also my teacher, and after about a week or two, I forget how long, I hit the wall, boom, which would happen during a retreat. It's like whammo. Can't do this anymore. And it happened actually at lunch, and I always used to sit at the same table as John, my teacher, and it happened, and I said to him, "John, I've hit the wall." And he said, "We need to talk." And after lunch, we went out, and we left the house, and we went to the hut that I was staying in. Went in and sat down, and I already realised something serious was going on, because he had trouble moving, but he was dying at this stage, and he had gone a long distance to have this talk with me. I thought, something's going on. So he sit down, and he says, he thinks about it, and he says, "Patrick, you're a dried up old stick. You've got no idea what your feelings are. You're just completely cut off from them. You can't possibly expect to ever get anywhere in this practice like this." And he thought about it some more, and he said, "It may be too late." And so at this point I go, "What can I do? What can I do?" And he said, "Contemplate feeling." So this is what I really started doing. It was great. It was fantastic. It just opened up this whole new world. I kind of rush into interviews each day. "John, this happened and that happened." It was really interesting. And then after a few days, I came in and he said, "How's it going?" And I said, "I don't know. I can't seem to do it anymore. Everything seems, there's no problem. Seems that the concentration is strong, the mindfulness is strong, and I'm doing it, but I'm just not picking anything up. It's just not there." And he nodded and he said, "Yep, neutral feeling is the hardest to find." And I realised he's right. It was neutral feeling. That's what it was. It wasn't don't know. It wasn't neither painful nor pleasant. It was neutral. It was genuinely neutral. And this is associated with equanimity. And it's very subtle and very pleasant, but not the same kind of pleasant as give me, but a whole different kind of pleasant. So that, so neither painful nor pleasant at that foundation level matures into genuine neutral feeling, which is associated with equanimity. Pleasant feeling, let's see. Actually, I'm not sure now. I've forgotten.
Can I just mention that I read a discourse somewhere that really struck me about these three kinds of feeling. And the Buddha said the third one, it's pleasant when known and unpleasant when unknown.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I don't want to anticipate our next experiment, but often confusion is painful. Yeah. But being clear about confusion can be fine. So, yeah, there's a lot of subtleties involved here. Are we ready for our next experiment? So again, constructing the posture from the ground up. Experiencing the whole body. And from there, tune into the breathing. Once again, start to focus in on the breathing. Does it feel pleasant? Or does it feel unpleasant? Or can't you tell? Does the breathing feel pleasant or unpleasant? Or can't you tell? Open up to the whole body, experiencing the whole body. Just sitting, not doing anything in particular. Does it feel pleasant? Does it feel unpleasant? Or can't you tell? Any luck?
I think I heard all three.
Mm.
All the time. Depending on a thought that came before it, or part of it, or a feeling that something like it felt like. There was nothing clean,
mm-hmm.
but everything was. So the breathing was either pleasant or unpleasant, or I didn't know based on a sensation that arose before it, or the thought that came in about it, or so it became, didn't matter. And then when we, what was the next thing you asked?
The whole body.
The whole body. Same thing. I kind of identified if there was dependent on the background, if you like, what I labelled. What was happening.
So they were all mixed up, like moving from one to the other?
Moving
from one to the other.
Moving from one to the other.
Yeah, so not stable.
No.
But like an ocean of different feelings. One flowing into the next.
Yeah. I'm conscious that I've got quite a lot of aversion going anyway at the moment, so it's probably a reflection of that.
Mm.
Yes, it just seemed to be that there was nothing separate, that the breathing or the whole body was not separate from the wash of either feeling or thoughts or whatever that was part of. I couldn't separate it out.
So you got this whole network, interconnected network,
mm-hmm.
and the feeling tone is constantly shifting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
I had what to me was a pretty funny experience, because I found myself noting how I was responding to the words you were saying. So
mm-hmm.
if you said, you know, is it pleasant? I would have a pleasant response to that word. You know, is it unpleasant? I have an unpleasant. And do you not know? Didn't like that either. And it was very interesting to see how quick it was. I mean, it was just responding to that stimulus, as you had just mentioned a few minutes ago. Was, well, look for, you know, kind of the suggestion, is it pleasant? Well, pleasant things are, so yeah, that's pleasant. I mean, kind of think about even looking for it.
Yeah.
Is it unpleasant? Well, kind
of. Yeah. So again, the suggestibility comes up,
yeah.
and the speed, the rapidity with which the response comes. Maggie, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just moving from vaguely unpleasant in the lower body, the abdomen,
mm-hmm.
to very pleasant in the breath in the upper body.
Mm.
Just moving way back to the
body. But those parts of the body were fairly stable. Lower part, unpleasant. Upper part,
yeah.
pleasant.
Distinctly different.
Yeah.
Especially after breakfast.
Mm. Anyone get a pretty consistent dunno?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got consistent low grade pleasant.
Ah, consistent low grade pleasant. Brian, you got dunno?
Yeah, I found it was pleasant all around.
Huh.
Because if my breath wasn't there, that was going to be unpleasant. So, again, suggestion.
Yeah. So you set about to enjoy the fact that you're alive.
Yeah, I think it was good.
Mm.
And it was pleasant.
Mm.
I didn't work out there yet. It did matter.
Okay. Just one final note. Watching the meditation object versus feeling the meditation object. Watching seems to emphasize consciousness or awareness, what the Buddha calls vijnana, while feeling it emphasizes vedana. So these represent modes, different modes of experience. Often people will find that they prefer or feel more at home with one mode over the other. Some people are more it seems to be more natural to watch. Other people seems to be more natural to feel. Some people, six of one, half a dozen of the other. Always go for your strengths. If it's natural to watch, then just watch. If it's natural to feel, then feel. So you don't. There's nothing compulsory. It's not that you have to do this or that. And just go with what seems natural at the time. But notice that there are different modalities, different ways of experiencing. And as you open up to that, you may find yourself at different times experiencing in different ways. Any questions or comments?
Yeah, so I think emotion is part of sankhara. The Buddha talks about sankhara, and he identifies like anger, and there are obviously emotions.
Yeah,
I don't know. I haven't found a specific word for just emotions.
Yeah, and also in citta, he'll talk about mind states like anger and so on and so forth. But he's got seem to have a different classification system than we have. Okay, are we done? And it's independent schedule today.